It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media. Today, naturalist and hunter Steve Rinella talks the oldest connection we have with our food. That is as hunters. Steve's new book is American Buffalo, In Search of a Lost Icon. Now, I'm a bean geek. I mean, the more obscure the bean, the more I lust after it. And I've just met a comrade. Steve Sandow grows heirloom beans, and he's got a bunch I've never heard of. Now, food and music, not a new idea. I mean, remember Shakespeare's business about if music be the food of love, play on. But music critic Tom Moon has a new niche for food and music, the place you really need the lift, music to clean up by. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. The number is 800-537-5252. So let's get started with Jane and Michael Stern, brought to you by Las Vegas. Vegas Uncorked brings chefs from around the world to town this May. More at VegasUncorked.com. The Sterns write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine.
Lynn, at first we had a really hard time finding Café des Amis in Brobridge, Louisiana, because we were looking for East Bridge Street. Somebody had told us about this great restaurant on East Bridge Street, and we couldn't find it, and we kept passing street signs that said Rue de Pont Est. And then it suddenly dawned on us, we're in Cajun, Louisiana, and things here are in Cajun French. And Rue de Pont Est was, of course, East Bridge Street. And Café des Amis is, in my opinion, the quintessential Cajun restaurant. First of all, Brobridge, let me just step back and say, Brobridge has declared itself the crawfish capital of the world.
How far from New Orleans is that?
A couple hours. It's way out in the swamp.
Well, I'm already ready to go because I love crawfish.
Well, go there during crawfish season and, you know, you're going to have a real fe dodo. But any time of year, this place makes a point of serving true Cajun food. I mean, everything from beignets in the morning to gâteau syrup for dessert.
What is gâteau syrup?
We never heard of it. But, you know, this part of Louisiana is where they...
It's cake with syrup.
It's made with cane syrup. You know, they grow cane sugar there.
Oh, yeah, right.
And this is cake. It's kind of a spice cake made with cane syrup, a real dark, dark, sweet, spicy cake. It's delicious.
I can translate these things. I just can't say them. What's, Michael, say this word?
Oreille de cochon. This is like pig's ear. But what it is, it's a long strip of fried dough, kind of resembling a pig's ear. Mm-hmm. You can get it plain, and that's delicious. Or you can get it filled with boudin sausage. And let me tell you, the crunch of the crust and the kind of creamy, spicy boudin sausage underneath, it's the best.
Is this like a bistro? Is it like a roadhouse?
Hard to describe what it is. It's a restaurant that actually is located in what used to be a dry goods store. So, in fact, there's one table that's in the window, kind of elevated. You can sit, like, in the window, like your merchandise.
Like a mannequin.
But, you know, it's a party, especially on every Saturday morning from 8:30 to 11:30 a.m. They have what they call a Zydeco breakfast. The doors open at 7:30. You sit down and... there's a band playing Zydeco music.
You dine,
you dance. It's just heaven.
This sounds like it's fabulous. Now, do they
cheap also. It's $4 for the cover charge for the Zydeco breakfast.
Yep.
So they do dinner? I mean, they do breakfast, lunch, and dinner essentially?
They do breakfast, lunch, and dinner. I'm not sure if it's 7 days a week, maybe six, but what it is a town restaurant. You know, the locals love this mm-hmm. place. And, of course, because of the Zydeco breakfast and because of the great Cajun food in general, people come from, they come from New Orleans and from all around, because this really is, I don't know, it's kind of a social center for people, not just a culinary center.
What great fun. Hey, guys, thank you.
You're welcome.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye.
Les haricots chauds, les vinipis chauds, les gens de couleur, One of Jane and Michael Stern's life-changing tomes is Two for the Road. Now, you know the Sterns are here every week, but you don't have to wait a week to get their food finds. Just check them out anytime at splendidtable.org. I've always wanted it all. So despite this economy, I've been mulling over how to keep eating well without spending a lot of money. And I figure maybe these initial thoughts might spark some ideas on your end. Like, cook from scratch, even if it's one or two nights a week. I mean, even if cooking isn't your bailiwick, consider this a time that you can try stretching yourself. And don't feel you have to reinvent the wheel. Take a look at cultures that have done the work for you, especially the ones where meat's kind of an aside and not the main event. For instance, look at the food of China. In fact, look at the food of all of Asia, Mexico, the Mediterranean, the entire Sun Belt. The other thing is, think about growing some food. I mean, even if it's taking a shoebox, punching some holes in it and putting some dirt in it and planting some lettuce seeds, you can do that on a windowsill. Try planting your own herbs. I mean, think about the price. I mean, $2.99 for five sprigs. You can do that. You'll have herbs all summer. And last but not least, really enjoy your food. I mean, really enjoy the eating. I think we get so preoccupied with schedules and talking to people and whatever, we don't really taste what we've got in our mouths. And let's face it, it's there for fun. It's not just fuel. Dried beans are like precious stones. No two are alike in looks or in taste. Now, you want the big thrills of beandom? Go for the heirlooms. Now, this is the kind of bean that Steve Sando specializes in. He's a co-author of a new cookbook called Heirloom Beans. Steve, welcome.
Hi, nice to be here.
So, Steve, how many beans are you handling at this point?
Well, this time, about 30, and I think it's too much because there's the average customer doesn't even know if they want to cook beans, let alone decide which of the 30. It's a lot. So it really is for specialists, but it is about 30 now. So,
you know, the thing I think people don't realize about beans is that I would bet you each one of those 30 tastes different than the one next to it.
No, and there's a reason for keeping it, either based on the way it looks or the way it tastes or the texture or what application. I mean, they're really – if you had red kidneys at a salad bar at a pizzeria, I would say, ugh, I don't like beans either. But when you go into these heirlooms and realize the nuances and the variances with them and the pot liquor or the bean broth and whether it's a thick skin or a thin skin, whether it's creamy or grainy, it's shocking. And what we're doing with the 30 is a cup out of the ocean. It's just – I mean, I'm doing everything I can. It breaks my heart to think there's a really great bean out there that I don't know about.
You'll find
going.
It.
I'm doing my best, yeah.
All right, but give us this is like saying, you know, pick your favorite kid. But the thing is, maybe three that we really should try that would really kind of be alluring.
Well, yeah, I call them my you'll be back beans. There's about 10 of them. The first heirloom bean I ever tried was called Rio Zape, and it's a purple bean with kind of black Kodai marks on it, and it looked intriguing. And then I ate it, and I thought, oh, this is like what I love as far as pinto beans go. Uh-huh. But then there's this back flavor of chocolate and coffee. And then I really noticed, because I grew up basically on canned beans, even though I love them, they were canned, the pot liquor. The Mexicans call it caldo. In the South, it's pot liquor. But it's bean broth. It's like, wow, it's like free soup. It's like your gift with purchase when you buy this stuff. And it's like, and with the canned, you have to rinse them, and it goes down the sink.
Yeah,
and you make it yourself. With an heirloom bean and a good bean that's known for its broth, it's like, this just knocked my socks off. And that's immediately I started going into heirlooms, thinking, I think I might have missed something here. And that was Rio Zape.
Now, is that from Mexico?
It's funny. It's really hard to decide where beans are from. Most of them are from Mexico and Central America. But this, the Hopi Indians had developed. But recently, I just worked with some Indians in Hidalgo, the state north of Mexico.
Uh-huh.
And they have a bean called San Franciscano. When I look at it, it's like, oh, it's Rio Zape. So I don't know who developed it or where it went.
Right.
But that's what's so romantic about beans is you can put some in your pocket, travel to Zimbabwe or Istanbul or Toledo, Ohio, plant some in the ground, eat them as green beans, eat them as shelling beans, dry some for next year and plant and start the whole thing all over again. Uh-oh. I mean, to me, it's just it's really romantic.
We're going to really get in trouble. Two more beans that you'd love to have us try.
Well, Vallarta is a fascinating bean. It's from the state of Jalisco in Mexico, and it's almost green when it's dry. And it's kind of ugly, and no one was really doing much with it. And then Thomas Keller from French Laundry decided it was one of his favorite beans. So we went from growing, you know, maybe 100 pounds a year to all of a sudden everybody wants to know what's this bean that Thomas Keller likes. And what I love is this bean now is thriving, and it's really, really thick, almost like peanut butter. And I think you need to kind of cut it with bitter greens or something make it. It's almost too much on its own. But I've heard that he purees it and uses it as a filling in raviolis. But he's got a staff, so it's a little easier for him to pull something like that off.
And a last bean?
Yellow Indian Woman's a fun one. It's a small yellow bean, and it's what I describe as a chili bean. And these tend to be kind of dense beans that are somewhat creamy, but this one's weirdly creamy. And the name probably is there was an Indian woman in Montana who they got the beans from. Mm-hmm. And it's a really prolific bean. We can actually get two growings in a season out of it. And it's really one of the best because it stays whole. It has a fabulous pot liquor. And you could just eat it on its own, which is my preferred way of doing it anyway. I just love maybe grating some onion, a squeeze of lime, and the beans. And I'm pretty happy.
One cooking method, because I know there are many, but one cooking method that you favor – for cooking your beans?
I saute an onion and garlic with some olive oil in the bottom of the pot. Then I add the beans and the soaking water, and I tend to soak for 4 to 6 hours, depending on what I can do. And if I can't do it, I don't even bother. I don't throw the water out because now there's possibilities that you're leaching out flavor and vitamins, and even if you're not, I don't really care. So I just do it. I bring it to a hard boil for 5 minutes, and I turn it down as low as it'll go. And I think they describe it sometimes as the pot smiling, just a little bubble now and again.
Right.
And just forget about it. That takes, for a fresh heirloom bean, which is something I describe as within a year, it's about I budget 2 hours, but it'll probably be less. But I think low and slow is the way to go. You can cook them faster if you boil them longer, but I think it compromises the skins a little bit.
I have to tell you, what I love is the idea I can buy a bean and drop it in the ground and grow this thing and eat it at all those stages. I think that's miraculous.
Oh, they're really easy to grow. And when they're fully developed, you cut the water and then you cut the plant and then it dries. And as the pods turn from green to, you know, they dry and get crackly, the beans go from white to these incredible vivid colors.
It's amazing.
Hey, it is, and we don't even know about it. And it's our own food, not to get on a soapbox.
Exactly.
I do.
Hey, Steve, thank you.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Steve Sando is co-author of the cookbook Heirloom Beans. Now, he left us with a recipe for drunken beans. You can find it on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to also check out all our other offerings. Our newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, our podcasts, information on our book, How to Eat Supper, and our latest brainchild, something we're calling Splendid Cheap Eats, a collection of inexpensive recipes culled from our archive. Also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Well, coming up, the cook, the naturalist, and the hunter, the after-dinner playlist, and your calls. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. Way that we humans got our supper was to hunt it and to gather it. Now, this idea of a store, for instance, is a very recent wrinkle. Writer Steve Rinella seems to have a deep connection to those times long ago. Steve is a naturalist and a hunter. He's one of those people who is far more comfortable in the wild than in front of the TV. Years ago, he literally tripped over a buffalo skull on a hillside. He's been digging into buffalo lore ever since. The research ended in a pretty harrowing adventure, which is documented in his book, American Buffalo, In Search of a Lost Icon. Steve Rinella, good to have you back.
Thank you for having me on.
So, Steve, what I'd like you to do is set a scene from the book for us, okay? The one where you're on the mountainside in Alaska.
Yeah, the book begins where I am on a river that drains the Wrangell Mountains in south central Alaska, and the river's called the Chetoslina River.
Uh-huh.
I'm about a mile from there. I made a cooking fire with some buffalo chips, and just uphill from me, I have about an 1,100-pound female buffalo lying dead, and I'm mid-process in butchering and skinning and you know, dismembering the buffalo into its usable parts and beginning to move them down toward the Chetoslina River where I might be able to get them into a raft. And while this is going on, I have visitors hanging around. There's a couple grizzly bears, like sub-adult grizzly bears, who are seem to be very interested in my project, but I haven't had any trouble with them yet. And thus begins my story.
So you've got to drag this creature in some way, shape, or form down to a riverbank, right? And it's cold. This is really cold weather. Did you get this buffalo where you needed to get this buffalo?
Yeah, I did. I was by myself, so I spent 3 days getting it down into usable parts. And by that, I mean most of the carcass was boned out.
Right.
I left the forelegs on the bone. And I had other things like the skull I wanted and the hide I wanted. Uh-huh. And I wanted organs to eat and like bone marrow. And so I wound up with about 700 pounds of parts that I moved in 100-pound trips. So I made 7 trips carrying 100 pounds per trip about a mile through just like some of the thickest. It's like an alder-choked hellhole. Through that down to the Chetoslina River. And from there, I was still 3 miles away from my main camp, which is along the Copper River.
You could have died in the process of bringing that animal down that river. And what, you lost feeling and you still don't have feeling in your feet from the frostbite?
No, I did not have feeling in my feet for about 6 months. And what happened was I wanted to put the meat on these very small rafts called pack rafts and float it down this canyon. And for some reason, I don't understand why, I decided to do it in the dark at night. And I had a suit on. It's called a dry suit.
Right.
But my dry suit was full of holes. I didn't know this. So as I was in the river, you know, up to my neck or up to my armpits, trying to handle these rafts and keep them from flipping over and keep them from getting away from me in the rapids, my suit filled with water. And almost immediately, I lost sort of like all sense of reason. I just became obsessed with how thirsty I was.
Huh.
And I couldn't think, and I was just hanging onto these rafts, just sort of like dragging down behind it. And by the time I got to the mouth of the Chetoslina, I just shot right into the Copper River because I couldn't use my limbs at all. And at that moment, I really thought that I had entered like the beginning of death. You know, it was like I almost thought, wow, there's nothing you would do now. You know, there's no way you would be okay now in this situation. And then at that moment, a friend of mine who had come down to help me made his way out into the Copper River and snagged me out and drug me up. And then I got wrapped up in sleeping bags and stuff. And a couple hours later, I was kind of at least functioning. Mm.
So you got this buffalo to where you wanted it. What do you do with that amount of meat? I mean, is the idea of the hunting, you're going to eat what you hunt, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's all I do eat. I mean, unless I'm out in a restaurant or something, when I'm at home, my wife and I eat game meat. Like, for instance, last night I had caribou meat.
But this sounds like this is almost a religion for you. I mean, eating this way and living this way, and I guess what I'm trying to get to is what drives this need to hunt?
I wonder about that quite a bit. And it's funny because I never asked myself if, you know, I wanted to hunt for a buffalo. I just knew that I did. It wasn't a question. Yeah. But I've often asked myself why. And I think that it's on a bunch of different levels. You can't escape that I was brought up hunting and it's become my way of looking at the world.
Uh-huh.
And also, I really enjoy the experiences and the knowledge base that's come with it. Because I think it continues to give things back. And with hunting, I'm able to really do something that gives me a view of the world that very few people have anymore.
What is that view?
the view of the world. I mean, yeah. Well, literally just things like being on the side of a mountain with grizzly bears and 1,000 pounds of meat. I mean, those are things that really wake you up. And it's like some of the few times when I'm in the wilderness, it's some of the only times where I'm only thinking about one thing. It's like my mind is like a constant clutter of obligations and things mm-hmm. I want to do. Mm-hmm. But in those situations, I'm able to, for once, just think about one basic thing from the moment I wake up to the moment I go to bed. And it's a very soothing feeling for me to be free of all sort of the cultural noise that goes on. And also, I really appreciate the eating end of things and the game meat. And obviously, if I wasn't eating game meat, you know, I would never hunt. It would mm-hmm. lose all meaning to me. Mm-hmm. Just like sport hunting or trophy hunting would be a sort of a meaningless venture for me.
Do you think this is a basic human need or a basic human instinct that gets buried as civilization gets complicated?
Yeah, I think so. But I don't know that I would never prescribe to someone that they go hunting. I don't think that hunting is necessarily, it's not a necessity for everybody to try. You can live perfectly fine knowing nothing about hunting. Mm-hmm. But I feel that some people, myself included, for whatever reason, have that need and desire, and it hasn't been buried. And I don't know that I want it to be buried for me, you know. It's just largely become who I am.
Steve, thank you for talking with us.
Hey, thank you for having me on.
Steve Rinella is author of American Buffalo: In Search of a Lost Icon. Is a master of the food music mix. This man cooks in several senses of the word. Tom critiques music on NPR and Rolling Stone and a slew of other magazines, all the while chopping a mean onion. Now, I figure a guy whose life is music and who is into cooking has got some good ideas for pairing the two when I really need them. His book is 1,000 Recordings to Hear Before You Die. Tom Moon, welcome.
Great to be with you.
Tom, I got a challenge for you. Now, this is the dinner party hosts challenge. How do you get them out of the house?
Yeah, it is a challenge. And what I've found works really well is something that completely sends the mood into a different gear. So if you've been listening to Sinatra and everyone's sort of laying back and kicking back, mm-hmm. I discreetly walk over to the player and find some classical symphonic music that has some energy to it, and instantly people go, oh wow, you know, and you don't even have to say anything. All you have to do is have this on, and people go, okay, we're in a different mode now.
Well, what would you suggest then?
Almost anything works. I mean, I think the late Mozart symphonies are amazing, and Symphony No. 38, you'd put on the very first movement, Let It Go, and when you hear an inspired performance of that, you're just transported anyway.
See, I was wondering, what about Stars and Stripes Forever? Something like, you know, Susan March or something of that order.
Right, or Frank Zappa or something that's just so completely left field. That may send the wrong message. And, you know, the idea is you don't want to have to say anything. You just want to sort of encourage people to, you know, figure out how it feels to stand up again if they've been sitting for a long time or something.
Okay, so I've got them out the door. Now the cleanup.
Yeah. And I'm the chief bottle washer in my house, and so for me, this is the most important time. I'm going to get me something that will give me a positive attitude and just let me know that I can do this, that this is not an insurmountable challenge, that this stack of plates is not as big as it in fact seems.
Give me some specifics here.
Well, the best in the world for optimistic music is reggae, I think. Bob Marley and the Wailers. When you listen to Marley, what you're hearing is nothing is beyond your reach. And he has a great song from the record called Exodus, which is the song's called Three Little Birds, but the chorus says, every little thing is going to be all right.
Don't worry about a thing.
When you hear him sing this over and over again, this sort of very lilting, it's almost a mantra after a while, you find yourself, first of all, realizing that you are the equal to this challenge, and second, that you're already moving and you're doing it. And that's where music serves that subliminal role of sort of orienting you to your task. And Bob Marley's great for that.
I'm dancing to the dishwasher already. So then something to keep you going at that rate?
Well, the thing that I also thought about was often you spend an evening when you're hosting, you do a lot of talking. And so one of the things I felt strongly about was to find music that didn't ask too much of your sort of verbal skills or processing words. So a lot of what I picked is actually instrumental music. And to stay in reggae, one of the guys who was the sort of pioneers of reggae guitar, his name is Ernest Ranglin, has a record that came out a couple years ago called Below the Bassline. And this record is just, it's reggae, it's upbeat, but it's just instrumental music, and it's wonderful.
Oh, that's fabulous music.
Yeah. He was the guy who figured out that offbeat sort of rhythm guitar, chunk, chunk kind of sound could propel things for hours. And all the guitarists in Jamaica copied what he did. Huh. And he's like the father of reggae guitar.
What about jazz?
Oh, well, and then, you know, perfect segue, because Ernest Ranglin thinks of himself as a jazz musician in a way, a great place to go is jazz guitar. And there's no shortage of amazing jazz guitarists. One of the ones that I love is a guy from New Jersey, the late Tal Farlow, who sort of figured out his own way to play the guitar. He had a technique that was not like too many other people, but he played in bebop era and then the post-bop era of the 40s and 50s, and what an inventive talent. And just, you put on any of his records, the one I like a lot is called The Swinging Guitar of Tal Farlow, and it's just, it's peppy, it's upbeat. Again, you feel like you could scrub for hours listening to this.
Let's have a listen. Oh, Tom, I like that a lot.
It's great music, isn't it? And it is something you can go with for an hour. That whole CD, just wonderful like that.
I think I'd take that for the whole evening. But okay, but for those who need lyrics.
Yeah, well, there are a lot of great singers, and you know, you maybe don't want Aretha Franklin or someone who's like a real siren and hitting you over the head, but a singer from the UK named Beth Orton made this beautiful record that sort of works as a Sunday brunch record, but she also works really well for sort of taking care of the small details and making sure that the kitchen's cleaned up. The record's called Central Reservation. She has a beautiful sort of cracked, aching voice, and you don't have to pay attention to the words to get like a nice, calm feeling out of Beth Orton.
She leaves secrets in her hair, whispers and that has to share. She's deep as a well.
Is sensational.
Yeah, it's something else. It's the kind of thing where you did hear about her a lot 5 years ago. She hasn't made a record in a while, and I really hope she's working on one now because I love her.
Huh. Okay, now the wind up. Yeah, we're all done, ready to collapse.
Well, and there you do need something that sort of finishes off the evening, right? You need to feel like, okay, you have accomplished something. And the great singer Chet Baker, great late trumpeter and singer Chet Baker, was one of these guys who could sing a sad song and just make it feel like the most sublime experience in the world. So any of the songs from his record Let's Get Lost, the best of Chet Baker Sings, they're all transfixing, amazing recordings. I pick I Remember You just because it is sort of that wistful thing at the end of the night.
Long, long ago, say an hour or so, desire smile. I remember you. You're the one who made my dreams come true a few kisses ago. I remember you. You're the one who said I love you too. Didn't you know? I remember too a distant bell.
Oh, he was a fabulous singer, wasn't he? So sexy. Oh.
Yeah, and just very calming, and you know, he's one of those few musicians who his talents fed off each other. He was a great player, but then when he sang, when he decided he was going to put the trumpet down and just sing, he put you in a place just immediately. You hear his voice, and you're there.
Well, I'm toddling off to bed. Tom, thank you.
Thanks so much.
Music critic Tom Moon's book is 1,000 Recordings to Hear Before You Die. Now, to get Tom's cleanup playlist, go to the website, splendidtable.org. Well, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now, the question is, how did the Astomi tribe nourish themselves? Well, we'll be back with that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, how did the Astomi tribe nourish themselves? The Astomi were a tribe of men covered with hair who had no mouths. They nourished themselves on the scents of plants. Now, this comes from no less than one of ancient Rome's great naturalists and intellectuals, Pliny the Elder. He was writing in his famous Encyclopedia of Natural History. Now, Pliny usually wrote about things that he observed firsthand, but in this case, he must have been charmed because he trusted a very imaginative Greek historian who wove the tale that these Astomi men came from eastern India. They live solely on the aromas of certain roots, flowers, and wild apples. And he said that one strong whiff of a foul odor could take them out. Of course, the first thing that occurred to me was how thin they must have been.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me. Maybe it's late, but just call me.
The lines are officially open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Anything goes. Okay, let's see who is on the line. We have Sam calling from, I'm hoping I'm pronouncing this right, Sam, Andalusia, Alabama, as in Andalusia in Spain?
Well, that is perhaps a little continental. We just say Andalusia.
I like that better.
Andalusia, Alabama.
Andalusia, okay. So what do you want to talk about?
I am a stay-at-home dad, and I have two children who are 3 and 5, and we always have a wealth of green grapes. My kids love them. They love to eat them. So when I buy them, it seems like, but it always seems like there's just far more left over than what they can ever get through.
Right.
So I was just wondering, I have tried a couple of different things. And of course, I have used them in chicken salads and cold dishes and things like that.
Right.
But I was trying to see, is there anything that I could do with these to either make a dessert or something that's warm or something that would be a little more useful than just a salad?
Mm. Well, if you've never tried them in things like oatmeal or hot cereal, they're really good. I mean, just think of a plumped up raisin, because that's what a grape is. I mean, they really are great. And if you maybe you cut them in half, the little ones, but mix them in. If you want to get them to eat any kind of whole grain cereals or, you know, things like that,
sure.
Put some of those grapes in. One of the other ways you can use them is sautéed greens like spinach or chard.
Well, that is amazing, okay?
Yeah, and what you would do is, you know, you'd sauté a little onion, a little olive oil, throw in those leaves, wilt them down. If you want to, add a little water to let them soften up and cook. And toward the end of cooking, throw in the grapes and maybe some very lightly cracked whole almonds.
And that sounds delicious.
Does that sound great? It's a great way to sell greens.
We're big greens eaters here, and we, in fact, of course, you know, it's the garden is full of that at this time of the year down here, and so we've got tons and tons of kale and turnip greens and all kinds of things. So that is a wonderful idea.
You really feed these kids well, don't you?
Our kids, they have been guinea pigs for us for a lot of different things. One of their favorite foods from early on was avocado, and so they still love it. And they're not as high on greens as they once were, but they'll still eat them. So.
Hey, you've done a miracle there. If you can sell greens, this is fabulous. You know the other thing you can do?
Sure. What's
pizza.
That?
Pizza with cheese, maybe greens, maybe some broccoli, and maybe a little bit of sliced onion, very thin sliced, and you scatter it with the grapes.
Oh, that sounds delicious.
And I would never
have thought of that.
Yeah, well, you know, just think of this. Anywhere a raisin would go,
right,
a grape can go.
True enough.
So you know, you can play around with that. And then, obviously, you can do a fruit salad with them. And the other thing you can do is do a syrup. I mean, you can actually crush them, mix them with a little bit of sugar or honey, and cook them in a sauté pan with some water, and then puree that. And you've got a nice syrup, and you can use that on pancakes and that kind of thing.
Gosh, Lynn, you are just a wealth of ideas. Thank you so much.
Wonderful. I just think it's so great to have too many green grapes, you know?
I'm never shy. They always put them in these huge bags, and I'm never shy just taking out what I don't want and just purchasing what I want by the pound. But still, even at that point, it seems like we always have way more than what the kids can eat. What a wonderful idea.
Good. By the way, they're great frozen. As a snack.
Well, we love that in the summertime down here when it's 90 degrees for about 2 months.
Oh, yeah. Sam, thanks for a great question.
Thank you, Lynn.
You take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. 800-537-5252. We've got Susan on the line from Newport Beach, California. Susan, what do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about mac and cheese.
Oh.
Something very simple.
Oh, yeah, but so good.
Well, I heard from you exactly that you had a fabulous recipe for it, because a couple of weeks ago, my husband and I were driving in the car, and we always listen to your program, and you were giving a recipe. You were talking to a woman, I believe, about great fried chicken and how to get the outside to stick.
Right.
She was having trouble.
Right, right.
And after you resolved that with her, and she was going to make it, she said something to the effect of, oh, I'm going to make a side dish of mac and cheese with that. And you said, I've got a great recipe. I immediately picked up the car phone and called you, and my husband said to me, what are you doing? I said, I'm getting that mac and cheese recipe.
Hey, guess what? It is on the website, splendidtable.org. It's called 21st Century Mac and Cheese, and it breaks a lot of rules.
Okay, I'm on the website right now.
You are? Okay.
Yes.
21st Century Mac and Cheese. It may be under sides or under foolishly lighter fare.
All right.
a misnomer. It's not that heavy, but I can give you the basic idea.
All right. I've tried a couple, and I've had a couple outside, you know, in restaurants. And the only phenomenal one that I've had was from the Four Seasons, but...
Such a pricey way to go to have
mac
and cheese.
Yeah, that's a pricey way to go, and it had truffles in it. You know, it's like a heart attack on a plate.
Yeah, yeah, and the lobster and all that business. Yeah,
I'd like a nice dinner one.
Yeah, this is more plebeian.
Yeah.
But the deal with it is, you know, normally you make mac and cheese by making what's called a cream sauce or a bechamel, where you melt butter with flour and you cook that, and then you add milk to it and you boil it, and that's your sauce, and then
right.
you add cheese, and then you toss it with the pasta, and then you bake it. And I realized that was always too heavy for me. So this is what I do, essentially. I mean, the measurements are on the website, but essentially I use an egg as the binder instead of heavier flour. So you boil up a couple of cups of pasta, you put it in a shallow baking dish that you've buttered or oiled, and then what you do in a blender, you have an egg, you have milk or half and half or cream depending on how rich you want it, and then you have some garlic, all right?
Yeah.
You have 3/4 of an onion or a small onion that you've just cut into like a couple of big pieces. There's a reason for that. You have about 10 ounces of cheese.
Okay.
And that cheese should be something like a sharp cheddar, an Asiago, a Gruyere, something with a lot of character, but not something that's really, really, really stingingly sharp. You don't want a blue. And the other half should be the most underestimated and undervalued cheese we've got, cream cheese.
Oh, really?
Yes, because real cream cheese, not the skinny kind.
Right.
You know, forget this low-fat nonsense. It's a luscious, inexpensive, delicious way to get a lot of good kind of lush, fresh cheese flavor into something.
Oh, what a nice little surprise.
Yeah, it's a little trick. I throw in some more cheese, too, like a Parmesan, something that has a little more character. But the point is, it's a lot of cheese, a little bit of red pepper flakes, a little bit of tasty paprika. So it might be a Spanish, might be a Hungarian, it could be sweet, it could be hot. And then you just blend that together in the blender until the onion is in little pieces, and you pour that over the noodles.
Oh, okay. Wow.
And then the big deal here is you take a little butter in a sauté pan, and you break up into big flakes saltines, and you toss them in the melted butter, and you put the saltines on top of that, and you bake it about 20, 25 minutes, and the saltines get crunchy and
crisp.
So
the saltines are your breadcrumbs, basically.
My breadcrumbs, but they're in shards.
Yeah.
And they toast, and they get buttery, and they are so sexy, I cannot tell you. And my mouth is watering at the very thought.
Well, I may make it for dinner tonight.
Hey, if this weren't my recipe, I'd still want to make it. No, but seriously, Susan, give it a shot. It is not the traditional mac and cheese, but, you know, and you can always doctor it to your own taste.
Right.
But I think it might be worth a shot.
Thank you so very much.
You are very welcome, and thanks for listening.
Well, I do all the time.
Hey, you take care.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
You know, mac and cheese is really underestimated. And let me tell you, you go out and spend the money for a hunk of cream cheese and you can do a ton of things with it. You mix that with like a, you know, brown up like a 1/4 pound of hamburger, throw some noodles in there, throw some tomatoes in there, and then throw a few hunks of cream cheese. This has nothing to do with Italy, by the way. Nothing to do with Italy. This is sort of American 1940s supper stuff. Absolutely delicious. Delicious. Okay, call us. 800-537-5252. I've always been inspired by the rhythm of life in the kitchen, the ebb and flow of chopping and washing and stirring. Well, we've discovered that others feel that rhythm as well, particularly poets. Poet Jane Hirschfield joins us today. Jane, it's good to have you with us.
I'm happy to be here.
Now, I understand you cooked as a professional. I mean, you were a professional cook, and not just in any restaurant. I mean, you were in the seminal vegetarian restaurant in the United States, Greens in San Francisco. How did you come to this?
Well, this is why one might not want to call me quite professional. When Greens opened, as you may know, it was started by Zen Center of San Francisco as a Buddhist practice place as well as a restaurant. And, you know, many restaurants in the Bay Area do have a history of connection to broader issues. The famous Chez Panisse began with Alice Waters serving dinner to her friends so they could talk politics together.
Yeah.
Delancey Street was a place for people in rehab to work and still is. And Greens was founded as a form of right livelihood for Zen Center as a source of income and a place of practice. Food and Zen have a long connection. The Tassajara Bread Book was how I first found out that there was a Zen monastery in America. And so I was simply assigned to work there. When they first opened for dinners, I was told that that would be my next form of work as a Zen student.
So how did you react to it?
Well, I was a little terrified because most women who had been at Zen Center had done some time in one or the other of the kitchens, and I was something of a feminist when I myself was at Tassajara, and instead of being put in the kitchen, I was put in the shop. And so I walked in my first day and looked at Deborah Madison, our founding chef, and she said, "What's your experience?" And I said, "None, Deborah. You're going to have to show me how to hold a knife."
"I'm really good with a hammer."
And she turned white a little and showed me how to hold a knife, and thus began 3 years of wonderful cooking experience.
Well, there's a poem, evidently, that came out of that time. Could you read it for us?
Yes. It's called Cook. Each night you come home with five continents on your hands: garlic, olive oil, saffron, anise, coriander, tea. Your fingers blackened with marjoram and thyme. Sometimes the zucchini's flesh seems like a fish steak cut into neat fillets, or the salt-rubbed eggplant yields not bitter water, but dark mystery. You cut everything to bits. No core, no kernel, no seed is sacred. You cut onions for hours and do not cry. Cut them to thin transparencies, the red ones spreading before you like fallen flowers. You cut scallions from white to green. You cut radishes, apples, broccoli. You cut oranges, watercress, romaine. You cut your fingers. You cut and cut beyond the heart of things where nothing remains. And you cut that too, scoring coup on the butcher block, leaving your mark. When you go, your feet are as pounded as brioche dough. And, you know, this is the nature of vegetarian cooking. It is very high prep. You're using the density of labor to replace the density of meat.
But this is so interesting because part of what I was hearing was sort of a winnowing of an experience or of a life, that cutting to the heart, cutting to the seed, and cutting into that as well.
Yes, absolutely. And that, of course, is the element of the Zen way of practicing with food intersecting with restaurant work, in that it is all completely about mindfulness, and mindfulness in relation to whatever you are doing, whatever activity that is, and particularly food.
Yeah. Maybe ultimately food, when you think about it, the connection,
well,
the life. It is alive as we are.
And I think that, you know, our relationship to food and eating is a very good microcosm for our relationship to all of life, in that it's got to do with appetite and what we do with appetite. It's got to do with simply what we need, you know, preferably several times a day in order to continue. It has to do with how we navigate our relationship to desire and whether that's going to be blunt or nuanced, generous or stingy. And you know, the deep pleasure of the most basic food, you know, bread or rice or a good egg, that is limitless. It's absolutely limitless.
Jane, thanks so much.
My great pleasure.
Poet Jane Hirschfield's poem is Cook. Now, for more information on her books, check out our website, splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you this from Storm Jameson. She said she did not so much cook as assassinate food. The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and supported in part by Las Vegas. Vegas Uncorked brings chefs from around the world to town May 7th through 10th. You can see them in firsthand cooking demonstrations and taste their creations at parties at Vegas resorts and restaurants. VegasUncorked.com. You'll find information on almost everything you heard here today on our website, splendidtable.org. And there's much more than just what you heard here today. Not only will you find newsletters and podcasts, you'll find information on our book, How to Eat Supper, and find a selection of inexpensive recipes to get you cooking in your kitchen. Also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Andrew Schumacher and Judy Boudreau. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Brett Baldwin. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. We'll be back next week. You have a good one, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.